Hubhopper Originals.
To start your podcast for free, log on to studio.hubhopper.com.
So Dash, from everyone in India and Indian Jeans, we'd like to welcome you back here. I think the last time we spoke was a couple of years ago, and I have to tell you that that particular episode got a lot of listeners. We in fact had a few questions. People wanted to know a little bit more about AI, and I guess today it's all about ChatGPT. But before we get into that, Dash, once again, welcome and thank you for talking to us here.
Oh, thanks, Joachim. It's a pleasure to be back. And, you know, it has been a couple of years, but I feel we've been in touch and formed a close relationship. So it doesn't feel like I've been gone too long, but it's a pleasure to be back on. And thank you for having me.
Since we last spoke, I think there has been a lot happening. So, Dash, why don't you tell us what have you been up to and what's happening in your area?
Yeah, sure. Since the last time we spoke, I was at that time working in a biotech company doing AI to try and build better image analysis models to detect, you know, different biological markers and signals in biomedical imaging for a specific type of microscopy at the time. So it was kind of a niche area, but very much using the same tools that I'd learned and I still use in machine learning and AI. Since then, I've moved on. I've joined a new company. My focus in my new company, which is Accenture, has been on how AI, data science, and all things related to that type of cutting-edge technology can help businesses. So it's a little bit more in the applied area and business heavy, but it gives a different perspective, particularly on the impact technologies like this can have. And that's really what drives me, is seeing how we can improve the world, the businesses, the industries, and everything really in our society using technology. And AI is one of the most relevant technologies we have in today. The adoption of it is only increasing. In particular, how we will use it moving forward, which we can discuss a little bit later, will be really key into some of the directions that we think will take across, you know, business, sciences, the arts. And that's something that recently I've also I've gone back to my old school, Oxford, to become a tutor in AI and how it helps across all of these areas. So, you know, keeping myself busy as always, and it's good fun to be part of this exciting journey of AI and more generally these types of technologies.
You are the right person, and why not start straight away with what every second, if not every third person, is talking about, and that is ChatGPT. Now, I think when it comes to AI, people, or most of us listening here, have got a little bit of understanding on what AI is and how this all came to be. But if we get straight to ChatGPT, and I was to ask you, where did this start, this transition from us using the word AI, then to ChatGPT? And we do hear about 2015 as when data was being collected or when this project was actually launched. But if you had to simplify it for us and give us a little bit of a history on this.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a good place to start, in particular for, you know, the history of ChatGPT really is the history of AI. It is a specific model that is an AI model, and it falls in the category of what are called large language models. So, you know, if there is somebody who doesn't know what it is or has played with it, you know, you feed it textual information and it gives you an answer. So it's like typing anything into Google and getting an answer. So it's a chatbot. So, you know, this type of AI called natural language processing has been around for a long time. If we look even further back, the real history of AI as we think of it today started probably in the 50s, when people started using the term AI and formalizing it as a concrete area of mathematics, which is what it is really. And since then, we have developed, particularly in the last 20, 25 years, a very deep understanding of how we can use algorithms to analyze large data sets to learn patterns, basically. So historically, chronologically, that's how we've built up, let's say, starting from the 50s to in the 90s, when there was a lot of work being done in machine learning, more generally about algorithms, particularly in images. The ideas of neural networks came about around then. And the real breakthroughs that led to models like ChatGPT, which are these language models, or generative AI, which is often what it's called in the context of text, came about, as you say, around 2015, 2016, when people started to really think, how do we get really human-like responses to text input? So if we ask questions, how do we get a model to learn and predict what is the most appropriate set of words and sentences to output based on that response? So the technological breakthroughs relied on a couple of algorithmic interesting breakthroughs, which were something called transformers, and also a mechanism called attention when we analyze textual information. These two combined in a nice way are really what underpin these large language models like ChatGPT that we see today. So really, it's a journey that started right from AI and the concept of learning patterns from data, and specifically focused on textual information. In the last few years, these breakthroughs for understanding text in a very context heavy way is what's led to models like this that allow us to engage with it in a very human-like format. When you talk to it, when you ask it questions, the responses are very, very human-like, which is quite amazing.
And if I had to ask you, before we get a little bit more deeper into ChatGPT, about an algorithm, because that's what we hear a lot, and then today it's more about coding. But as a basic, if we go to, let's say, class one of an algorithm, for somebody to start understanding it, do you have any example, a very simple example that explains what an algorithm is? Is it a choice between green and blue, or is there something within your field that can be used as a starting point where anybody can understand the concept at least?
Yeah. I mean, that's a good place to start. So in a very simple way, an algorithm is a set of rules that you use to basically say, if this happens, do that. And if that happens, do that. So as a simple example, you can take a mathematical function, any function, and say, if I give it an input, it'll give me an output. And that's an algorithm in some sense. In a very, very simple sense, that's what it is. In terms of mathematical understanding and underpinning of what we use in AI today, algorithms are usually more data-driven. So as a simple example, instead of coding up a function that says, if A happens, do B. If B happens, do C. If C happens, do D. Let's say that is the algorithm. What happens now is, and what's really at the heart of machine learning, is instead of telling it a set of rules, if A happens, do B, C, D, what you do is you say, A is an input. I'm going to learn by giving lots and lots of types of information that will fit under A, and learn the function itself. So I won't have a set of rules, but a function that is learned from data, which underpins the pattern of what is the output. So instead of having, perhaps a better way of saying it is, instead of having inputs and a function that leads to an output, machine learning is basically take inputs and outputs and learn the middle part, which is the function, which is the algorithm. So the algorithm itself in AI is something that is inferred from data, as opposed to being a fixed set of rules. Does that make sense?
Very interesting, yes. So what you're saying is, when it comes to initial algorithm, it's a clear decision, left or right, for example. And if you turn left from there, it would be something like a decision tree, or that it would branch out again. So with every decision and every turn, you would have a set pattern, a set rules laid down. But with what we're talking about now, when it comes to either ChatGPT or algorithms or machine learning, like you said, it's not so much about the outcome, but the function that you are actually inputting. And then it is about expected outcomes or most probable outcomes, right?
Yes, that's right. So the thing it learns itself in some sense is the pattern, and then then what you do is once you've learned the pattern, you use that pattern to create new data. So you'd predict, let's say, the classic example is you train an algorithm to learn what a cat looks like. Okay, so you feed it thousands of images of cats with labels saying these are cats in the image, and then the model learns the pattern and says, okay, this is what a cat looks like. And then you can give it new images and it will recognize the cats without having actual information saying it's a cat, as an example.
Right. And is this also related to whenever I log into certain platforms or get locked out of certain platforms, you have these blocks of pictures that are asking you to tick, let's say, a street light or a bicycle. Is this data going in somewhere to what you were earlier saying, that are we unknowingly training some form of AI here?
This is a really interesting question. I never thought of it in that way. So the purpose of those images is actually the opposite. It's to counteract these things. So the purpose of those images is usually to identify that you're a human, right? That's what it says. We want to identify you're a human. So it asks you some sort of question about, you know, look for, I don't know, streetlights or whatever it may be. Because the idea is that they don't want, AI chatbots or any kind of programs accessing those websites and spamming them or attacking them. So they try to, it's a security safeguard, basically, that they try to encode with those types of images. So it's actually the opposite. That's what they're there to do. Now, with improvements and probably the people who make those for security purposes, I'm sure will be learning those patterns themselves to make those pictures even better, so they actually can't be detected by more models. So I think you'll start seeing more and more sophisticated types of authentication tools that that will be needed, because AI will become good enough to learn it.
Right. And there will be a time when that's it, because if we look at AI and we're talking about the future of AI, then there is just so much as humans we can predict, expect, or identify, right? The growth is going to be much more. It may be the other way around, where the AI wants to know whether we are humans or no, rather than we wanting to know whether they are AI or no.
That's a very, but potentially. This leads to a very interesting area, you know, of when we talk, I know we'll get into it in a bit more detail about the future of AI and how it's used. But since you brought this up, I think it's a good segue into a very important area of the ethical considerations when it comes to AI. You know, it's a tricky business, because the better these models become, the more human-like outputs they give, the more likely we are to use them and actually believe them. Now, you know, in the 50s, there was the term AI was coined at what was called the Dartmouth Conference. The pillars, one of the pillars traditionally of saying, when do we say something, a machine is, you know, almost an artificial intelligent operating entity. One of the tests has been canonically the Turing test, right, which probably you've heard of, or many people have heard of. The idea there was, it's pretty straightforward, that Alan Turing suggested, if you can't detect the difference between the response of a machine and the response of a human, then you can classify that as being truly intelligent. Now we can argue towards the validity of that test, but it seems at face value to be an interesting, certainly reasonable thing to ask, right? If you can't tell the difference between what you're talking to, then you would class those two things to be the same. And we would like to think humans are intelligent, at least to some extent. So would that machine also classify as intelligent? Now, if you take models like ChatGPT and these types of tools, they probably, you know, most people probably can't tell the difference between AI, between those and humans. So I think we're approaching, or maybe already have crossed, that particular test or that threshold of what intelligence should be. And the question then is, what do you do about it, right? You know, do you have to put some sort of constraint? So for example, you know, you can ask a model like ChatGPT, tell me how you would go ahead and, based on information that you know about my company, make the next 5 years strategic objectives and forecast plan of what we should do, right? Let's say you ask it that. It's going to be able to produce outputs to that. It has enough context if you've trained it on your company's information, which companies don't do that right now. But if you do, that's something it can do. You make some decisions, and the model is going to sound very convincing. You know, it's going to tell you what are the most reasonable outcomes based on the data and so on. But then how do you use it? Do you say, I'm going to go ahead and implement these strategies and start putting in place whatever things it says? Like, for example, it could say you need to cut your workforce by half. And that's the most efficient way to become profitable again. What do you do, right? Is that the right thing to do? You know, there's all types of other considerations one has to make when making decisions like that. So we're rapidly approaching the stage where we need some sort of guardrails around what we think the tool should be used for, right? We shouldn't forget it's a tool that we use to help us. We should be sensible about how we use it. So at the moment, there aren't any industry standards or government standards, so to speak, which are very focused on understanding the boundaries of what can and cannot be used for AI in any type of industry, be it the sciences, the arts, whatever it may be. So I think that's something that we will have to think about very carefully. There is one point I should mention that the European Union has put in place something called the AI Act, which is supposed to be these types of regulations and policies around how and when you can use AI models in different criticality events. So if something is really critical to a nation's infrastructure, let's say you want to use AI to balance the electricity grid to know where electricity should be going during the day, because you predict users' preferences and so on, that has to meet certain standards in terms of its accuracy, transparency, and so on before it can be used. So that's a bit of a flavor around the question you mentioned around, you know, where do we see AI kind of fitting in going forward, particularly in the society as we need to adopt and use it and potentially face consequences with decisions that are made or at least supported by AI. It's a very, very fascinating area about kind of the high level ethical considerations. There's plenty more that we can get into, perhaps if you want now, or if you want, we can return to it.
Sure. Yeah, I think we'll get back to the ethical aspects of AI. And coming back to ChatGPT, so for example, what we would do prior to ChatGPT, let's say pre-ChatGPT era, is you get to Google, you type in whatever you're looking for, and then you get a page or you get 10 pages in sequence related to what you've just typed in. So it's very specific. Now,
correct.
Could you give us a back-end understanding of ChatGPT? If I type in something into ChatGPT, back-end, how is that different, or how does it work? Where it can, for example, if I say, I add your name and I say Dash Godwani, and in the style of Dash Godwani's PhD thesis, right?
Yes.
And I will get that. Now, how does that happen?
This is a it's a great question, right? And it's there's a systematic way. So if we think of it as, you know, as a logical sequence of steps, then certainly we can kind of break it down as to what happens. So when you type something into ChatGPT or a model, like, what has happened? So the first thing that happens is it'll take the text and it takes the words in it and turns it into a mathematical representation. They're usually called tokens. Now, what's really interesting is when you do that, if you just take those words as is and try and learn patterns of the words, that's what we used to do in the initial kind of era of natural language processing. But that's not enough, because you gave a very good example. Suppose you say, write me this piece of text in someone's PhD style, or as if Stephen Hawking was saying this. You know, you give it an additional piece of information, which is context. So what it does is it needs to understand context. And really, this is the fundamental breakthrough of all of these models, is the understanding of context. The way that happens in the back end, as you ask, is you take these words, turn them into a mathematical format called tokens. I can maybe just describe in 2 minutes what ChatGPT specifically does. Is it converts not just the word into a token, but potentially even chunks of a word into tokens. So it might break up the word token into T-O and K-E-N as two separate subwords, and then tokenize them. This is done for various kind of reasons of, it becomes easier to then find representations between them, but it breaks down the word into even subwords through a process called, I won't go into detail about it, but it's something called BPE, the algorithm itself is called. And that's done for the fundamental reason that you want to find a pattern between the words. So this is, this tokenization is followed by a procedure or a tool or a mathematical function called a transformer. And this is the breakthrough. In fact, the name, the T in ChatGPT stands for transformer. So GPT itself stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. That's what it stands for. So the transformer then takes all of these words as an input, and it actually tries to find not just, it doesn't just take the words, it then tries to find the patterns between the words. So in 2017, there's a very famous paper which was written called Attention is All You Need. And the reason it was called that is they introduced a new concept called attention, which is a mathematical way of saying you find the relationship between the words that are in your sentence. So if you say you take a statement, say I love watching football, what it would do is it will take, for the moment, let's not worry about breaking the words, you would just say I love watching football. These are four words, and it'll ask the concept of attention is you take each word and try and figure out how important it is for the next word and all of the other words in that, not just in the sequence, but also like all of the words in that sentence. So does I depend a lot on love or watching or football? And this is a very simple example, but that's mathematically what you do is you say, how important does this word relate to the rest of the words? So as you can imagine, that's a pretty large set of things it needs to compare against if you have, you know, a book that you're trying to train on, right? So it requires a large amount of computational power, and that whole process of finding the relationship between the words, finding the pattern between the words, is what happens after they've been converted to tokens, and then they learn the patterns based on the information you provide, and then, because it's learned the context as well, and it keeps the context from what you've been typing into your browser, the output of the model is predicted. It predicts a vast range of outputs that are feasible for the inputs you gave, and then it fits it into the context before providing it to you. So in some sense, it kind of reverse engineers what it's predicted, puts in the context, and then presents it to you. This is sometimes done in an encoder-decoder network framework, which I won't go into, but the basic idea is you do exactly what you did to learn the pattern and then reverse it before you give the output. So those are the kind of three or four high-level steps. You take the text, you convert it into a mathematical representation called a token, you put it into an object called a transformer, which is, you know, fairly complicated neural network type structure, and then you predict what the outcome should be, put in the context, and then send it out to the user.
Very interesting. Very interesting. You touched on Attention is All You Need, the white paper. And I think Eric Weinstein has been speaking a lot about it. I did listen to his interview recently. I'm not too sure on on what channel. But I'm just wondering whether it's the same white paper. He also rated that as probably one of the most important papers of our time. Besides, he spoke about the blockchain revolution, but he said that this was one area that seemed to be pretty interesting, right?
That's right. And this was the fundamental breakthrough in enabling these types of GPT-type models, generative pre-trained transformer models, yes. Because before that, we didn't have a way to understand context, right? And that's the beautiful thing about our language, is there's, you know, it's not determined by just the words. It's determined by the sequence of the words and the logical structure between the words, right? That's what a language is. In fact, the words are kind of, in principle, replaceable, right? You can have words that could mean different things in different situations. You can use different symbols for it. What gives the thing meaning is the structure within it and how the words relate to each other. And even more broadly, if you take a story, right? Imagine you were training a model to learn the pattern and be able to write in the style of Harry Potter books. Now, in Harry Potter books, there are specific characters, a specific meaning to different words, right? And like, it would need to know that, in Harry Potter, there is this mythical creature that I don't know, whatever the name may be, that I need to know about, right? So it needs to have that level of context and that the attention breakthrough, the algorithmic breakthrough and the concept of attention really enabled an efficient way to capture context.
Right. I think also, and correct me if I'm wrong, this would have helped as far as when we talk about, let's say, the English language, because the English language is spoken differently in different geographical locations all over the world. But for example, the way Americans or British or Indians use words and language, if we go only for the actual words, then this context could be lost and you could come up with another result. But does that mean that because of this new attention that you're talking about, that aspect of language from any part of the world is then not an issue anymore?
It's not an issue in as much as the information that you're training your model on captures that. It depends on what you've provided the model, right? It's still, as much as we like to think of these things are intelligent, what these are very, very highly trained models. They're basically models that have been fit to a lot of data, right? ChatGPT has 175 billion parameters. It has, there's basically numbers coded in 175 billion of them that have been learned from data and represent this, the patterns that it's learned. So as long as the input data that you provide is a good representation of the languages that you're talking about, then yeah, it should be able to generalize. What is very interesting is there's a concept called transfer learning in machine learning or in AI. And let me describe that because it's going to help understand a little bit more about the question.
Sorry, Dash, before you get there.
Yep, no, tell me.
You said 175 billion parameters is what AI is trained with. ChatGPT. What is the context as opposed to? So what else is trained by what number? Just so that I understand the difference.
Yes,
compared
sure.
to what?
Very good question. Yes, that's important. So you have something to relate to. So what that means is 175 billion free parameters or numbers were fitted in this model. So the model itself consists of that many pieces of information in some sense. As an example, in 2010 and a bit after that, there was a model called BERT, which was a pretty sophisticated language model, which was used for a lot of the applications in understanding reading text and so on, that had around 100 million parameters. So this is 1,000 times greater than even that was. And then, the initial language models themselves would have had anywhere between a few hundred thousand to a few million parameters. It's gone from, a few hundred thousand to a million to a few hundred billion. It's a massive difference in in how many free parameters it has. And in some sense, the more number of free parameters, the more complicated the model is. And it's just that's because it's been trained on so much more data. The ChatGPT has been trained on like a large fraction of the data that exists on the internet. You know, it's a massive amount of information. So it's only as good as what you've trained it on. And this particular one and GPT-4, which is since ChatGPT, it's been released as a newer version of that, has a little bit more in terms of juice, but that's the range in which we're working in at the moment.
Right. And please continue. I stopped you on your next point.
No, thanks. That was a good question and very important to set context as well. I suppose there's an interesting aspect here which we haven't touched on, which is the ChatGPT falls under the category of models called generative AI models, which is the set of AI models that are used to create new information based on what they know. So it's not completely new. I mean, it's new, but it's based on what's already happened. And in that category of models, we also have image models, which generate images. And those have been used for, I think, even a bit more, have made more progress, actually, before ChatGPT became so popular. And they have very practical examples, the image models. So if you like, we can go into that direction a little bit and talk about the image models too.
Yes, I think we will. And I'll remember the image models before I take you off course again. But I just wanted to understand from you, Dash, the information that is now being collected by ChatGPT, for example, is if you talk about, and I'm just thinking whether this even makes sense, but level one, for example. Now, moving forward, as ChatGPT improves, or you could have some other system that comes in and something that we don't know as yet, as far as technology is concerned, then does it need to get back into everything else as far as information online is concerned? Or has ChatGPT, in a way, built this platform where we don't need to go beyond, let's say, 2015? ChatGPT has done all that for us going back, and now we just keep picking and building from here onwards.
Yes. So this is a great question, and it reminds me of what we were discussing before, which was transfer learning. And this is the same, the answer is falls in the same category, which is, do you have to start from scratch, or can you build off from where you are now, right? That's where you're getting at. And it's very much the concept of transfer learning is that you, once an AI model is trained, you can retrain it, or you can, adapt it to a different area with minimal training. So for example, speaking of languages, let's say, if we've learned the patterns and a lot of the context of, how English language is written, it's possible that you can retrain that AI model that's trained on the English language on a different language by minimal effort, which is called transfer learning, where you say, okay, I'm going to give it, if I needed, let's say 100 gigabyte of data to train the first model, I might only need 1 gigabyte of data to train the next one by using what I've already learned and then building on top of it. So you don't start from scratch. You always build on top of what you have. So in the same way that you're asking, would ChatGPT has been trained on data up until 2021, from what I recall. So when we need to make the next version of this, we will build on top of it. Or, well, it depends on the company. So ChatGPT is owned by OpenAI, the company. And I'm certain, and obviously OpenAI will be basically using what they've already learned in ChatGPT or GPT-4, which has already superseded ChatGPT, to build on top of it with new data, with potentially some new changes in its algorithmic structure and so on.
Right. And I think you were getting on to image learning.
Yeah. So similar concepts apply to images, actually. So, in the example I gave earlier, when you train a model to recognize images of cats and dogs and a few other things, and if you want to train a model to recognize cars, you don't need to train a model from scratch. What you do, technically speaking, what you do is, these are models based on large neural network architecture. So you have lots of layers of neurons. in these models, what you would do is you would remove the last few layers of the neurons and then retrain them on the new data while keeping, let's say, 90% of the previous neurons in your network. That's kind of technically what happens. So in images, there's a lot of applications of generative AI as well. So you can create new images. The first kind of simplistic way of thinking about it is something that we've been doing for a long time, actually. Our phones do it, our computers do it, which is removing noise from images. So, our phones do a lot of this in the background before we even know it. But when you take an image, if it's blurry, if it's moving, if there's some noisy pixels, the image, the algorithms in our phones now will reconstruct what it thinks should be in that pixel if there's some noise in it, and fills it in. It's called in painting. So that's a technique that's very useful. In fact, I used to use that when I was doing astronomy as well. So we've used this in trying to analyze data from telescopes. So there's times when we used to be making observations. There'll be noise in the image, or there might be some object that you're not interested in. So you want to remove that from your image and still have fill it in. So the techniques for what's called in painting the information into the image is something that we've used for a long time. But now what we can do is generate new images completely from scratch. And the fundamental breakthrough for that, in the same way the attention paper that we discussed earlier was a big breakthrough for the language models, was a paper in 2014 about something called Generative Adversarial Networks, GANs. It's a paper by Ian Goodfellow. And the idea there is that you basically take two AI models and get them to compete to make the better image. Schematically, that's what we do. And that's an area that's very popular. There's some really cool applications of that in art, actually, that we can start talking about once you want to start talking about applications. Images is another big area for generative AI, including text. So in addition to text as well.
Right. So why not continue? Because we've already gotten to art, but for example, different applications with ChatGPT, and as end users, we do see a lot on Instagram. We see these pictures all over the place, amazing pictures. And then you're just shocked to know that the detailing and everything was just fed in, probably the concept was fed in. And then you get this absolutely realistic, detailed image of, let's say, a mythological character. And you can put in a story and it just draws a face for you. That is very interesting, right? Especially for art.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's interesting on many levels, including ethical ones, but we'll get onto that in a minute. I mean, in terms of the applications, as I say, the applications exist in art, in science, and business. A large part of them are the ones that I mentioned, when you're improving images as opposed to making new ones. But certainly making new images is very, very interesting. And you can do things like a particular favorite of mine is something called style transfer, where you say you learn the style in which a particular artist draws and map that onto some other artist's image or just a picture of a house or something. The way this thing works is, suppose you have an image, you have pixels, you have the patterns in it. The way the neural networks work that detect the patterns in the images, there's these layers, as I say, and each layer in some sense will be used to detect a specific pattern. So as an example, in a very simplistic example, you can have five layers of neurons, and each of them is there to detect a specific shape in an image. So the first one might be to detect circles, the second might be to detect squares, the third might be to detect triangles. Let's just say that. A very simplistic example. So it looks for that pattern in the image. And then, by looking at those patterns, the model could say, this particular artist uses a lot more curvature and circles in their image. So it'll detect that pattern, at an abstract level. And then suppose you have a picture of a house and you say, draw me the picture of this house in the pattern, in the style of this particular artist. They'll just add more curves and make it look more round. There are a lot of cool tools that you can play with online that enable this. And I can share some links if people are interested. But that's a very interesting area. But you can go beyond, as you say, and literally come up with them from scratch. And the conceptual framework is exactly the same. You would say, you know, let's say you say, make me a picture of a basketball player who's based on Lionel Messi, let's say, a footballer. And then it'll learn the patterns that exist in pictures of Lionel Messi and then put them on top of what it thinks are the patterns of a basketball player. That's how it works. It basically works by first abstractifying a pattern and then extrapolating that pattern onto a new thing. That's how these models work. That's very interesting in terms of art, at least.
Yeah, very interesting. But just my thought, Dash, if you go back to pre-internet, mm-hmm. for example, and you talk about creativity, and you mm-hmm. I'm just sticking to art now, and you talk about different art styles that evolved. Yes, they all branched out, but everybody keeps going. You can keep going back and finding some similarity or pattern with an artist from another era. For example, you can go back to Picasso, you can go back to Da Vinci, and we can all keep going back because there's some aspect or pattern of every painter in the next painter's work. And if you keep going back, well, you reach the first painter who painted cave art on a cave. So what ChatGPT is doing, or from what I can hear you telling me, is pretty much the same thing, but now it gets a little bit more ethical or unethical because we've understood how it's being done. There's a little bit more thought being put into play. But if it comes to you naturally, then it's creativity because it's just happened, but subconsciously you are picking up from somebody.
This is a really, really interesting area and gets right to the heart of the ethical consideration for art in AI, which is plagiarism. Right. Now, you make a very interesting point, which is for humans, right, there's potentially some level of subconscious plagiarism that inevitably happens. That's possible. It's hard to prove or it's a tricky area. But it's very true that seems like it's probably inevitable. For AI and these models, it's clear, right? There is they will produce what they have seen based on what they've seen. So it's a very, very tricky business of saying, you know, if it's creating art in the style of Da Vinci or Picasso, you know, who owns the rights, the intellectual rights to that particular piece of work, right? Is it really something new, or is it really just being, you know, is it something that is the work of someone else, and this is just relearned it and then presented it? I don't know the answer to this question, but these are the exact questions that I think we need to answer. And we're getting to the stage right now because of how good these models have become. You've probably also seen them creating songs and music and styles of Drake or whoever you like. So I think now we're really in that area in the next 5 to 10 years where we'll need to think very carefully about on the creative side, where does the boundary lie between plagiarism and IP rights and so on for art that's created in this way? It's a fascinating area.
Right.
And I don't know the answer. I'm just fascinated by it myself.
Yeah, same here. And talking about applications in various other fields. So, for example, from art, we could get to education. You could get to the commercial world. And again, I'm just on that same point trying to understand, if ChatGPT is going to give you answers based on everything that has already happened, so there is hard and raw data there, and all that hard and raw data that has come from humans. Now, if you look at some of the best ideas that have come, have been these out-of-the-box, out-of-the-world ideas that nobody has thought of before, and you don't see a trend building towards it. So if you're looking for solutions from AI, then is it fair to assume you will get solutions, you'll get practical, functional solutions, but you're not going to get those big aha breakthrough moments, those out-of-the-world ideas, because it was never in sync anyways all along?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I'm not super sure. Again, I know the answer, but if you think about it, you know, the models definitely work based on what they've seen so far, but there is a certain amount of randomness in them. So you can incorporate randomness into the AI model. In fact, that's how a large part of them work. So, you know, every time you type a prompt into ChatGPT, the answer is not always exactly the same, right? It's slightly different. So there's some amount of randomness that's put in. So they still want it to make sense, but you can make it a little bit different. Now, what happens if you start increasing that randomness is the question, I think, is a different way to phrase the question that you're asking. Is if you increase a lot more randomness into these models, can you get real out-of-the-box thinking where it's like, you know, suppose you're asking it to draw a picture of a beautiful sunset, but suddenly it thinks of, I don't know, something from outer space or something. And then puts a flavor of that in there somehow. Would we class that as out of the box thinking? Yes, but maybe not to the extent that you know we would really think of as groundbreaking ideas. I don't know. I think there's also, it depends. It gets to perhaps a deeper question of what we really think is a brand new groundbreaking idea. Like, does it come from, you know, somewhere in our mind that is completely dissociated from what we've seen in the world? Or is it some combination of ideas that already exist in the world? Now, I can tell you in the sciences, at least from my experience, I think a large fraction of big breakthroughs happen by combining two different ideas from different areas. They're rarely something just out of the blue. It's like, if I think about this particular phenomena in a very different way that's used over here, what is the outcome? So, you know, I think that level of creativity, I think we will see. Whether there's creativity beyond that, for example, if I think as a physicist about Einstein's breakthrough when he described general relativity, it's a fundamentally different way to think about it. He said, no, gravity is not a force. He said gravity, which is what everybody used to think because we think about forces all the time. It's the curvature of space-time. That's what Einstein used to think. That's the concept of general relativity. That is such a big leap. That is completely a different way of thinking about it. It's like, this is not a force. This is geometry. Can a machine ever do that? I don't know. But let me give you an idea that I have thought would be interesting, which is, you know, these language models are trained on, as we say, a lot of information that it's seen and found on the internet. I wonder if we will be able to get to a stage, particularly when they can take in inputs from images and graphs and numbers as well, if we can train models, let's say a ChatGPT-like model, on all the physics papers in the last 100 years. And then ask it, what do you think is a new theory of gravity, or the actual theory of gravity? What does it do? That's something I'm fascinated by. I would love to do that experiment. The reason it's tricky is you'd have to figure out a way in which it can read mathematical equations and understand them and graphs and images. But I don't think that's crazy, given the capabilities that we're seeing right now. So I think maybe, you know, in a bit more of a distant future, that's not going to be completely crazy as an idea, that you take a language model and you train it on scientific research and literature, and then ask it to predict the next big question. The next
very
big
interesting
answer. Yeah, it's very interesting, that one.
Yeah. So then, would you say, based on the algorithmic history of AI, let's say, that in an AI world, or as per AI, it's better that we live in a deterministic world rather than a world where free will thrives, because then the chances of AI become even more difficult, right? But if it is all based on information and it is all based on, for example, physics, like we are talking about, or the science that we're talking about, then there is hope at the end for AI to have all the information, like you just said, last 100 years or whatever, and predict the right theory, but then put in more information and it could predict the future, because that's all that it needs to predict the future. And there could be no ambiguity in the future anymore, because based on data, this is what is bound to happen. And I would know what happens to me 10 years from now.
Well, I mean, there's two questions, I think, here. One is, I think you're asking, is that likely or possible? And B, and the second question is, would that be a good thing? I think let's answer the first one first. Is it possible that would happen? I'd be surprised. I'd be surprised if we get to that level of understanding where it can predict what things will happen 10 years from now at a very granular level. But let's also be clear, in some sense, it does do that, and it has been doing that for many years. The whole purpose of AI is to be able to predict stuff. You've probably heard of many stories. The most famous one is in one of the most famous ones in the States many years ago with the company Target. Do you know about that one?
No.
Okay, so Target is a supermarket in the U.S. and they collect information about their customers. So, most retail stores do this, right? You have loyalty programs. They track what you're buying, your personal preferences, and so on. So they had developed an algorithm to understand how best to target advertising. At their customers based on what they were buying. So an AI model was used to learn the pattern and predict what is the best thing to advertise to people. And what they used to do is then, back in those days, they would have leaflets that they would go and give out to people's homes, with vouchers saying, here's a discounted price to buy XYZ. So a customer there, she was, I think, a young teenage girl. She was targeted by these advertising, and she was getting leaflets to buy baby products in the mail. And her parents got very upset with the store, saying, why are you asking my teenage girl to buy baby products? This is not good. And there's a lot of press and a lot of heat on this particular case. And it turned out a few weeks or a few months later that that girl was actually pregnant. So the AI had learned that based on her shopping patterns before she even knew.
Wow.
So in some sense, as I say, it's pretty powerful, and it can do a lot of pretty incredible things, like predicting certain types of behaviors, predicting events that have a large amount of kind of repeatability in them. It's good at these things. Whether it's ever going to become good enough to be very accurate at a very granular level and say 10 years from now you will be doing this in this profession, I doubt it, but you never know.
Yeah, and even today, in fact, I didn't know about this Target story, but that is very interesting because it's gone to another level already, right? So, and I can only talk about myself, because the moment I am surfing for a particular product, or even if I'm just looking at a couple of pictures based on what mood I am in at that moment, then the moment I open my laptop or my app again, I'm bombarded by sales pitches for that product. And that becomes so interesting. And it reminds me of this movie. And for people listening to us and trying to figure out how do they get this off their back, it reminds me of this movie called How Do You Train Your Dragon? And there's a way to do it, right? So there's a way to do it for your phone. There's a way to do it. I mean, just spend 10 days with a lot of discipline and you can detrain it. You can train it to show you what you want. You can train it to show you what you don't want. So it doesn't enforce. I don't think any secret cabal is sitting down there pushing ideas. It's just following your pattern. So if you change the pattern and try it out, you will see that it follows that pattern. So it's a question of how best to train your dragon.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it. Absolutely. And what's kind of interested, particularly for businesses, is there's a beautiful book called The Prediction Machines. It's written by an economist or a couple of economists, and they go on and kind of extrapolate how the use of AI will lead to different business models. And we're talking specifically about advertising, and the best example is in that, actually. They say that it is possible, if not inevitable, that we will get to a stage where Amazon or whichever e-commerce company you like to think they all use it, will be able to predict with an accuracy that's high enough what you want to buy or what you will need in the next week. That not only at the moment what they do is target the ads to you, right? They send them to you on your phone or on your app. It's possible they'll become so accurate that it'll be more beneficial for Amazon or whichever company to actually send you the product at your home, just on a day, because they think you will need it, because they think the model will be, let's say, 80 to 90% accurate, that the return rate, and obviously they also know there's an inertia in returning anything, would be only 10 to 20%. And at that point, the value proposition is large enough that you're better off for Amazon sending it off and getting, you know, 20% of the items back than waiting for the person to do it, which, you know, they might procrastinate or do later, and you'll only get 50% of the product in the end. So it's a very interesting example they give, that we're going to get to the stage when it's actually more valuable for the company to send you stuff without you even asking and waiting for you to reject as opposed to you buying it.
And we get into your earlier quote on the ethics of all of this, because if this is the first step of predictive shopping, then we get into a Tom Cruise Minority Report movie where you could have predictive behavior and predictive, you know, you're expected to have committed or you will commit this crime. So why not just lock you up right now? Because everything else is predictive anyways. And yep, if it is this way, then why not that?
Absolutely. And that's a slippery slope that we need to be cautious of. Absolutely. And we're getting close to that, you know, very close to what Minority Report and movies like that say. And so, you know, in ethical considerations, I think this is one of the key ones. I think for me, there are basically four or five really important areas. There's A, which is the classical issue of having bias in your model. That's number one, because it's the most obvious one. The models that you train are only as good as the data you've given them, you know. So you have to make sure that the data is not biased in any way, right? We know a lot of examples of this. When you train an AI model, for example, to scan CVs and feed them historical data, if for a particular job those CVs have always been, the people who've been selected have always been male, let's say, and that's the only data it's seen, and then you ask it to analyze new CVs, it'll only select males, right? So that's a very crude but very obvious example of bias in data that the model is trained with. So we need to be very, very cautious of that, particularly as they become more and more complex. You know, the biases will not be as obvious. They may be like not everybody's, just as a simple example, it might be that not all the males are selected, but it has 5% bias, but that's still not good enough, right? We need to be very clear in how we're training these models. So that's for me number one. Number two is actually related to this, which is you need to be able to understand how the model is making decisions, and having some level of transparency of what exactly is it selecting on. How is it selecting the CV? Is it just the gender? Because that shouldn't matter. The simple way to mitigate that risk is you don't put in the gender, right? But having a transparency of how the models are making decisions and predictions is going to be key to the adoption of these, particularly in very critical areas. And I think then beyond that, in the era of generative AI, as we discussed in sciences, in arts, plagiarism is a very, very kind of interesting and subtle area that it's hard to understand how we go about putting in place some regulations or policies or norms about how it should be used. It's a very tricky area, but I think that's going to be very important on an ethical front, is thinking about plagiarism and policies for creative arts.
Now, Dash, we talk about all of this AI, and the outcome of this or the source of this or the platform are a couple of social media platforms. And when I say, I'm talking about the larger audience, because professionally, people have their own platforms to work on it, or companies or organizations do. But we're talking about platforms like Twitter and Facebook and ChatGPT now and whatever we have there, Instagram, for example. And I've always tried to understand, is it, we are talking about the medium through the platform at the moment, because it gets pushed out through the medium, through the platform. But do we, or have we ever reconsidered or re-looked at these particular platforms themselves? So, for example, what I'm trying to think about is Twitter, or you take Facebook, right? It was made probably by an 18 or 19 year old for 18 and 19 year olds. And that was it. Now, because of scale, it evolved into what we have today. And right now, as we sit, we've got 55 plus and 50 year old politicians and geniuses arguing and blocking and canceling each other on that platform. And it reminds me of me walking into my son's room. My son is 18, where his friends are around and trying to be part of that, and then lecturing them on what they should be doing in that room. So what I'm trying to get at is there a need to probably not put everybody in one box? Because for obvious reasons, people think differently at different times of their life. That's the confusion to start with. You have values, your values change. So we have 18 plus driving license, 21 plus voting license. Is there some logic in what I'm thinking, or there's absolutely no sense in what I'm saying? But what I'm getting at is it time to probably understand that people at different age groups or times of their life need to be at different places? They all just don't need to jump into that one room.
I think that's inevitable. I think that that has to be done. And if used properly, these two, you know, the AI tools can actually help. You know, they can help understand the preferences and how they evolve over time. Because as you say, people do evolve over time, and categories evolve over time, and personality evolves over time. So I think these tools can actually help. In particular, an area I think we've discussed offline before is education. You know, how do we tailor education to different people in different stages of their life? You know, the most obvious one is in school, but people, you know, we all learn throughout our lives. And how we should learn, and you know, what are the most reasonable and effective ways in which we should be sharing information, conveying information, is, while it may seem it's an area of pedagogy and teaching, you know, it's critical to everyday life, right? How we communicate, how we best get a point across to different audiences is critical for any area of life, right? In business and in any area, you need to be able to convey something to someone else, and everybody is different, right? A famous example one of my teachers gave me was, you know, if you have a room full of 20 people, you're not teaching 20 people, you're teaching 20 personalities. And if you think of it like that, it's very important that we are able to not put everyone in one bucket, but tailor and personalize. And I think education is an area which is really going to be able to benefit from these tools. But not limited to education, of course, but that's an area that I think is really critical where we need to do this.
Right. And you spoke earlier about transferable learning models in AI, but what about transferable skills for students growing up? And we now know that probably conscientiousness, for example, I can just remember one, is going to be, and being a lifetime lifelong learner, these two are going to be the top skills needed for the future because of all the change that we have. Now, in your opinion, do you think that talking about education and talking about academics, we are preparing our next generations for that, or are we still following what we knew, but we need to radically and drastically rethink this whole process?
I think we're somewhere on a crossroad, in my opinion, where, you know, to a large extent, the methods, the processes, the framework of education is what it's been for, you know, last 100 years or however long, where we learn in school or universities and it's classroom based. But I think in the last maybe 20 years, not 20, maybe 10 years, you've seen the advent of these massive online courses, websites like Coursera, Udemy, which are in some sense democratizing the use of, opportunity of education to everybody and across age groups, geographies. And I think that's becoming more accepted. It's not, it's still a minority, a large minority actually, of people who would, think of this as mainstream education. But I think that's a beginning of something that's going to evolve and completely, change how I think we will go about doing education. But I think that'll take a bit of time. I think one of the things that did came out of the pandemic was we all got more accustomed to learning online, working online. Parents have become more appreciative of using those tools for children, for themselves perhaps. So I think that is a catalyst that's going to help this process as well. So I think we're kind of figuring out what is the next way in which we're going to continue learning and developing. And then speaking of, what do I think going forward, the type of skills or jobs will be, I think, as you say, the point will be, there'll have to be a lot of reskilling. A lot of the kind of day-to-day things across day-to-day operations in business or administrative work is likely to be automated by tools like the ones we have today, generating reports, monthly reports or newsletters or whatever. These are things that can be automated. So we'll have to, constantly figure out the next set of professional skills that people will need. But I think in terms of the scientific skills, I think that those will stay largely the same. I think there'll be a slightly less emphasis on programming going forward in the sciences area, because ChatGPT and tools like this are very good at writing code, and they'll become even better. So the emphasis will go, in some sense, for the betterment on figuring out and understanding the logic, the mathematics behind it, as opposed to learning the syntax of code itself. But besides that, I think, as I say, in the arts, there's going to be much more of a dilemma of how people work and use these tools. And, you may not make a whole new song with a generative AI model, but you might get parts of it. And is that okay? Or where does the line stand? So I think in the arts, it's a much more interesting area. In the sciences, I think the core concepts that people need to focus on will be actually what they used to be in terms of mathematics and less so programming. And in business, I think we'll have to constantly relearn and reskill professional services. That's my thought.
Right. And since you're in the future, Dash, which camp are you in, whether it comes to how far is AI going to go? So Sam Harris thinks we've all got to take care right now, right here, and probably stop it and rethink, because this could be danger signs for humanity. And the other end of people think that, no, this is the way to move forward and there is no reason to stop, because there is no threat or there is no danger, because machines will remain machines. There is no chance of them becoming conscious and taking over the world. But we've been hearing, and I guess, mind exercises as far as, or thought experiments as far as we hear about the paperclip exercise and the paperclip theory. Where do you stand with all of this, Dash? And what is your thought through this?
So, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's always interesting to try and forecast, where we will be. But I think it's probably not as black and white as should we continue doing what we're doing or stop and think about, the potential impacts of this. Firstly, I don't think there is a black and white answer, but secondly, also there's no practical way in which it's going to be either of those options. Both will need to happen and both will likely happen we'll keep progressing in our development of AI and other technologies, obviously, like any technology. But it's important, and if anything we should learn from the past is it's important to give equal consideration to the long-term impact of these technologies, right? That's something that we should learn from the past, that you know, if we don't think through, then there can be impacts of all types that we don't foresee. So it's important to invest equal amounts of time thinking about where it'll be. So I think it's not either or, actually. And this is not kind of a cop-out because I want to sit on the fence. I actually think that's the only way we will, you know, that's the only way to proceed. Because, you know, you need better tools to make progress. And how you use a tool is in the end up to you, right? Every tool can be used in a good way, in a bad way, whatever it may be. And I think we just need to know what are all the ways in which it can impact us. So I think it'll be, and as I say, you know, the European Union seems to be putting in place this AI Act, which puts in some regulations and policies for AI models that can be used in very kind of critical areas. It does mean that obviously cyber attacks and these types of things will get increasingly more sophisticated, because again, technology is always used for all purposes. There's not much we can do about it. But that means we'll also have to have even more stricter policies and regulations of how we deploy an AI model such that it can be resilient to the more sophisticated attacks and so on. So I think it'll be both is the answer, in my opinion, of how we'll proceed going forward. There is an area kind of very long term, which I do think about, which is, and I think this is actually going to be set back because of the advances in the types of models we have, because they're so useful, is a deeper understanding of how machine learning as we do it today works. You know, it's not often talked about very much because people are so amazed by the applications, but we need a much better understanding of how we construct these types of machine learning models. You know, how do we select the architectures of neural networks, and what do they actually learn? What do they actually present? And especially if we want them to make decisions, how are they making a decision? I think that's good. That's probably going to take the pace at which that particular line of inquiry is happening is going to slow down, because people will be fascinated by the applications and start using them. But I think in the long term, that's something that we will really strive to try and do. And this will come by a better understanding of the mathematics of the algorithms that we're using. But I think long-term, technologically speaking, that's something that is very, very necessary for AI.
Right. And do you think that with AI and all the development to come in the few years ahead, would AI ever develop or have the ability to develop softer emotions? For example, AI may not become conscious. That's a discussion for another podcast, probably, about consciousness in AI. But is there a possibility to develop values and beliefs to an extent? When you were earlier talking about language, you were touching on the intent of words. And the moment we get into that intent, then that opens the door for intentions which can lead to values and beliefs. Because if values and beliefs come into an AI system, then it becomes very important what you just said. What is the initial input into this machine learning? Because that becomes structured, right? And that could become the philosophy of the AI, irrespective of which part of the world they are from. It could just end up with whoever feeds that information into that particular AI. Because when you get into values and beliefs, then we have trouble, because look around us, most of the wars and everything we have is not about, it is resources. It ends up as being resources, but it always starts with the difference in values and beliefs and in different parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the models that we have are very, very capable of learning those because of the information they have. And in some sense, they do. This is where it's really important that we guardrail them. So, for example, even ChatGPT, if you play with it, there are certain things it will not answer. It will say, I'm an AI language model. I cannot talk about this. And we have to put those guardrails in. At the moment, all it can do is talk. But if you imagine a model that's also being able to talk and then take actions, like, you know, buy something or run some software or do whatever, that it's very, very important that we guardrail these things so that they can say or not say certain things or do certain things. And I think that'll happen, even in ChatGPT, that's already built in. And it'll, with the, as I say, regulations and policies that are going to become a very big focus now in the next 5 years, it's already happening. In the next 5 years, they're going to start getting very, very tight because of the use of it. We will have to put guardrails in to ensure that these models are behaving, or in some sense, they're not biased or unbiased based on specific values or belief systems. And you can try it. So, I tried one thing with ChatGPT once, which was you could do fun things like ask it, imagine company X was a car. What type of car would it be? or whatever it may be. Or you can say if this particular a football team was like an Indian god, which one would it be? It'll tell you. But then if you ask it, what type of mythical creature, if it has a bad connotation, would it be? It won't tell you. It realizes that that's not an appropriate thing, because someone would say, this model of yours is saying that my team or my company is like this evil monster. And that can have all types of ramifications. But it's programmed well enough to know that it can't say that. And I think that will have to become mandatory going forward. And it will. I think that's inevitable. But that's because a human will intervene and put it. A fact which is perhaps not very well appreciated in ChatGPT and these types of models is it's not completely automated. There's a process called reinforcement learning, which is when this model was trained, a lot of the inputs that were given and it was producing outputs were then rated by humans to say if this is appropriate or not. And it's learned from that. So, humans have had a very big involvement in making sure that what it produces is sensible and not offensive and makes, and can work. But you can imagine some other company who has other intentions not putting in these guardrails. And that's the example of, attacks and more controversial uses of this technology, which are inevitable. So we will just have to be building in a... we will have to build an infrastructure or a toolkit that can kind of counteract those efforts.
True, and I totally agree with you when you talk about guardrails, because as long as we have that, we at least know we are in control, whether it's positive or negative, whether it's a particular organization or company or country doing it pro or against, we at least still have that switch with us. But the moment we realize that we've lost that guardrail, and we are not in the driver's seat anymore, then it becomes dangerous, because who knows what happens from then. But what I wanted to ask you, Dash, you were talking about, I heard a very funny thing. I don't even know if it's true, but I'll check with you. So a friend of mine told me you type in please while you're asking ChatGPT to do something and you'll get better responses. And I found that very funny, but I said, seriously? So if you type in do this or write this, but if you say please can you, so the more courteous you are. And I was trying to think about it myself, and I just told him, I was like, it is still a machine, right? It's whether you say please or don't say please, it's going to give you an output anyway. So have you noticed this? Have you heard of this?
I mean, I have noticed it. I can't remember if I've heard of it, but that's how I actually talk when I type into it. I talk to it as if I was talking to a person. Nice. So I would normally say please. But I mean, it's going to give you an answer regardless. That's 100% true. What is true also is not just with please. It's the general concept of what we were calling prompts. How you prompt it is critical in how it responds. So please is kind of a side topic. But for example, if you asked, can you produce this? Can you tell me a summary of the Oppenheimer movie and limit it to 5 sentences? When you say limited to 5 sentences, that's a prompt that it'll then take and turn into something and say, okay, I'm going to stick to this, right? So those prompts, that's a very direct example of a prompt. But when you use certain words or certain sentences, which otherwise you may not think are important, the output it produces is different, slightly different. So whether you say please or not, the output it will produce will be largely the same, but there'll be some small difference. The context, the content should be pretty much the same. Perhaps it'll start learning the type of conversation you're having, and then it may eventually start talking to you as a more empathetic person. I don't know, that I haven't played with. because it can keep information about how you've previously asked it in a conversation, as when you talk to it in a particular chat, it keeps information about what you've said before. So it has all of that context still. But it doesn't carry it forever. It has a limit. I forget what it is, but it's a limit of how long it actually keeps that context for. But yes, definitely the concept of having specific words or phrasing things in a particular way does alter the output. That is true.
Right. And for somebody who's just getting into ChatGPT and is not using it, for example, for research or for writing papers or doing specific work, but is there anything that you would recommend that is functional for a person that does stuff daily, and by using ChatGPT, that's going to reduce your workload or that's going to make life easier for you?
Sure, actually. Some of the things that I use it for example, is if I need to plan trips or plan a holiday, I'll ask it, it'll tell me. So I can say, plan me a trip for 5 days in Barcelona under a budget of £1,000, it'll tell me. The other things I use it for are simple things like recipes. You can ask it to a recipe, it'll tell you. But more interesting ones are, and this is going to become actually integrated into Microsoft Office. They're going to release something called Microsoft Copilot. Day-to-day is something, it's going to be a tool that's embedded into the Office kit, so Word, PowerPoint, and so on, where you can ask it to, let's say, make you a PowerPoint of 10 slides on the history of AI, and it'll make it. So functionally, it can do a lot of these things. And this is what I mean by the nature of professional services work. It's probably going to change quite a bit because of these tools, this will be out in the next year or so. The other thing I use it for a lot is you can use it to check code that you've written or ask it to write code as well. So if you tell it, write me a code that can solve a 2D heat equation in a particular object, it'll write it. It's pretty amazing.
What should we not use it for?
I think don't use it for taking things for things that will. Don't use it to create information where you're going to make important decisions. I think that's very important, because you can't at face value trust exactly what it's saying. So anything where you're having to make an important decision, like going to the doctor or some particular medical procedure, or which stocks to invest in, actually doesn't even let you. It doesn't tell you which stocks to invest in. But if you try to get information about, how patterns in different stocks, you have to take that with a pinch of salt. But it's good, as I say, in that way, it actually will, for certain things, if you ask it direct responses, it'll say, you shouldn't ask me. It won't tell you which stock to predict, to purchase next. Stuff like this. But yeah, anything where you're, because what you'll normally do is if you ask it that, it says that you'll try and get other types of information that help you. Never rely on it for information that you're going to use to make critical decisions. You have to double check that always.
Mm. Is Alexa listening to me at home?
Yes.
I was hoping you would say no. That was a very clear yes. So what I do here is, so do we need to be worried? I would not want somebody sitting there listening to all my conversations. So when we were talking earlier about targeted advertising, or we were talking about the target specific, the target incident that you brought up, well, then mm-hmm. this is dangerous.
Yes, it is. There's two parts to this. It does listen. The question is, does it store? Right. It's always listening, right? That's how it knows when you say Alexa. The question is, does it store that information? And secondly, does it use that information? I've never got a clear answer of this, to be perfectly honest, on how it's stored or used. But there's a simple experiment we can do. I just haven't done it yet. Think of something like really different to what you would think day to day, something completely random, right? And start talking about it next to your phone or next to your HomePod or whatever. and see if you start seeing ads about it.
Yeah, that would be super interesting.
Right? The answer is yes. It's storing it and using it. If the answer is no, then, well, then at least it's not showing us that it's using it. So.
Yes. Yeah, it goes back to how to train your dragon, right? And
yes.
Also to check with you, I don't know if you are aware or in touch with what Sam Altman is doing at the moment, or what he's proposing or launching or has already launched over the last 3 years, but we're getting to know about it, the Orb, where people are being invited to get in there. It does your facial screening, your retina screening, and then all your information is, I think it's crossed 2 million subscribers worldwide now who have voluntarily given this information into this particular Orb that is then supposed to connect people and a network all over the world, which would bring all your data into one particular space or place. Now, this is all very interesting to me, but I definitely want to read more and understand a little bit more about it. But do you have some idea about this?
So it's the first time I'm hearing about it. So I guess I haven't thought about it or understood it. But from what you say, it sounds like an effort to build kind of a digital replica of you and the world around you, right? Which is interesting. This generally falls under the category of something people call the metaverse, where you're trying to make an exact digital replica of the world, including the people in it, how they behave, and so on. It's an interesting area. Again, I'm not super sure, A, what is the exact use of that, or B, you know, certainly the ethical considerations of sharing all of your data and having that being part of a simulation. Would I want to do it? I don't know. I would have to read a little bit more about it to understand exactly what it's going to be used for. But yeah, the general category of metaverse type ideas where you try to build digital replicas is not new, and actually quite useful in certain industries. Like if you need to do training for people in a hazardous environment, let's say in a mine, you know, you need to, when people go underground in a mine and do some work, they need to be trained into things. It's easier to do that if you have a digital replica and they can do it there, as opposed to go into a real environment, kind of like why we have flight simulators, I suppose. So I can imagine it being quite useful in certain situations. But yeah, overall, I'm not sure. I don't know if this is relevant or even related. The headset that Apple has released, the Pro Vision, looks very interesting. That I'd like to try, where you're trying to kind of have this mixed reality where you have this physical world and you can embed digital objects into it and then work and live there. It's very interesting. I mean, obviously it's built around the virtual reality concept that's been around, but that headset in particular looks quite interesting because it blends both of them quite well.
Right.
It's just very expensive.
It's expensive. It looks very cool as well. And Dash, before we let you go, our listeners would want to know from you, where do they find you, where you are located, if they want to get in touch with you, and again, if there's something you want to tell us, till we meet again, I'm sure we would love to have you back, but what would you like to say to people listening to you?
Sure, and I mean, thank you for giving me the opportunity again. It's always a pleasure, Joachim, to speak to you. I think, you know, connecting me, I'll drop you my email. You can put that into the podcast so people have my email. Feel free to reach out to me anytime. You know, what do I want to leave people thinking about with? I suppose, you know, a lot of discussion in this podcast in general, in the spheres that we live in, is about AI right now. That's what we're talking about. But I think we shouldn't forget that the thing that's generated AI is HI, human intelligence, right? You'll never have a rogue AI, as we were talking about, unless a human has created it. And I think we shouldn't forget that and focus on, you know, how we as people are learning and understanding the world and questioning the world and how to work with these tools. I think that's going to be really the thing that defines how we go about the next kind of phase that we're entering into our journey as humans. I think the next generations will have a different way in which they learn and think about the world and interact with the world. And I hope we keep human intelligence as kind of the founding principle there still, as opposed to artificial intelligence. In fact, we should just use AI like any other tool to enhance human intelligence. And that's back to our education idea of how we need to rethink education. So I think that's what I would probably end with is, you know, let's keep human intelligence still relevant, and it's what's going to define how we proceed, and hopefully use AI to actually help with human intelligence.
Brilliant. And once again, Dash, from everybody here in India, thank you so much, and you're always welcome back.
Awesome. Now, thank you, Joachim. Lovely to have another amazing conversation, and look forward to the next one. Thank you very much.
इस हब हॉपर ओरिजिनल को सुनने के लिए आपका शुक्रिया। अगर आप भी अपना पॉडकास्ट लॉन्च करना चाहते हैं, तो हब हॉपर स्टूडियो वेबसाइट पे रजिस्टर करें और एक मिनट के अंदर अंदर अपना खुद का पॉडकास्ट लॉन्च करें। यही नहीं, स्टूडियो देता है आपको पूरी आजादी कहीं भी कभी भी अपना पॉडकास्ट लॉन्च करने की, सिर्फ 3 आसान स्टेप्स में। तो साथ में अपना पॉडकास्ट शुरू करने के लिए तैयार, जस्ट हॉप ऑन हब हॉपर, सिंपली कॉन्टेंट।